Hey, welcome. I know we're like a small crowd today. Have no fear. This will be great. And who knows? This will be fun. Maybe like halfway through the talk, we'll have people wander in. Actually, it could happen at the end of the talk too. If on top of St. Patrick, someone had managed to get to 4 o'clock today without realizing that it was daylight savings, so they could arrive at 5, thinking it was 4. Anyway, so welcome today. The proud who've made it over at least 3 hurdles to make it here today. So Yale's spring break, St. Patrick's Day, and daylight savings. You get the gold star. So my name's Matt Crosman. I'm the lead pastor here, and as Alyssa said, we're in this season of Lent. And so we're starting a kind of new teaching series here for that season. A few years ago, Hannah and I spent most of a summer in Ghana, traveling and studying at a theological school there. We went because the year before, I had been introduced to the work of Kwame Bediako, a brilliant man of considerable education. He held 2 PhDs, one each from the University of Bordeaux in France, and one from the University of Aberdeen. That'd be very different. Aberdeen in Scotland. So if you think about that, if you're thinking that through, that's right. He wrote 2 dissertations, the first in French, the second in English. He worked on the intersection of theology and identity. His main question was, is it possible to be both truly African and truly Christian? He's writing in a post-African independence context, and that was a question that needed answering, certainly for him in his own life. And he helped me see how entangled my understanding of faith was with my own culture, and with a certain rationalizing, demythologizing, despiritualizing instinct. And he opened my eyes more and more to a dynamic vision of faith in which God was real and active and alive. Prof, as we called him, was just so wise. So wise and yet also so personable. I always tell folks that I've never met anybody in my life who was so brilliant and also so huggable. There's 2 things that didn't really come together for me in life before I met Prof. I found some video of him yesterday telling a bit of his own life story. He actually passed away in the summer of 2008, and we were there in 2006. When I found this video, I thought, I just have to show it to you. Just want to give you a chance to meet him, as it were. We didn't try this audio, so we'll see like whether this works.
I was a student of French studies in the heyday of the 60s, student demonstrations and agitations, and I was kind of part of that culture. What I think happened to me really was a sudden realization that living my life, building, constructing my life, without any reference to the transcendent, in fact, was a flawed outlook.
It's actually really hard for me to imagine a hippie prof. I mean, having met him at the time of his life that I did, really hard for me to imagine this hippie 60s prof, unconnected to the transcendent, as he described it, unconnected to the spiritual life. Prof was possibly the most spiritual person I've ever known. There was a groundedness to him. We can just like get that from like his demeanor. We'll hear more from him later. He was solid, but also subtle, right? He spoke with assurance. Prof knew what was important in life and what was not. He could ask penetrating questions, the question that you were hoping no one would ask, right? The question that would cut right to the heart of the matter. He was beloved by his community, a community of scholars and pastors and friends that he spent 2 decades of his life building. Prof was a friend of God. He talked about God as someone that he knew, someone he talked with regularly. And he read the Bible voraciously and with a confidence that God would meet him there and speak to him directly through that ancient text. He sang songs of worship with joy and with vigor. The prof was generous and conscious of the poor. Those who served in the kitchen and swept the floors were members of the community, equal to the professors and to the pastors who were there. The prof lived the spiritual life in a way that made you want to imitate him. And so today, we're starting a series on spiritual practices, essentially on the spiritual life and how to get it. This series will take us through the season of Lent, an ancient season of prayer and reflection in the Christian church, and will be a central part of a larger kind of faith experiment that I described to you on that handout that you got during announcements. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And so as we start this six-week journey together, my hunch is that the spiritual life is something that we all want. It's something that we all want, regardless of where we are in our journey of faith. My hunch is that we want to be spiritual people. We want to live the spiritual life. And I take it that by spiritual life, we would mean roughly this. The spiritual life involves a right relationship with what is transcendent, what is bigger than our own little selves, what is somehow both beyond and yet intimately connected to this world. Some might be inclined to call this transcendence God. Others might not be willing to go there, but we'd all have some agreement that the spiritual life involves this relationship to something bigger, bigger than us, bigger than our world, and yet somehow then gives meaning and direction to our own lives and brings peace and wholeness to our relationships to the people and to the world around us. The fruit of a spiritual life is a life lived in right relationship with the world around us, with people, with the environment. This fruit is much of our motivation, I think, in desiring the spiritual life. But the core of the spiritual life, at the core of the spiritual life, is this relationship to transcendence, or as I've experienced it, a relationship with God. And so we all want this spiritual life, we want this relationship with God because we have an intuition that the spiritual life is the good life. And you know, it's interesting that one of these psalms, the psalms are the kind of ancient songbook of the people of Israel. The very first psalm begins this way, and I think it captures some of this. It says, happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. But their delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law they meditate day and night. They are like trees planted by streams of water, which yield their fruit in its season, and their leaves do not wither. In all that they do, they prosper. I was so struck by this first point here, right? I love that it just comes out and says it. Look, the spiritual life brings happiness. I love that it just comes out and says it. In some of your translations, you get an over kind of churchified, blessed. But this is standard word. Certainly by the time it arrives in Greek, here's where I think we may actually get something out of the Greek translation of this. It's just standard philosophical word for happy. And that was the philosophical question. How do you live the happy life? And this is the answer. If you want to be happy, this is what brings happiness. Happiness comes from being plugged into relationship with God. So plant yourself near the stream. Learn to live life with God, to hear God's voice, and to live with him. Get plugged into God, into God's law, the description of life the way that God intended it to be lived. But there's something more here that we should be sure not to miss. There's a deliberateness, a purposefulness, an intentionality to this life. The ancient songwriter talks about a daily meditation on God's law. And the fruit is born regularly in season. There's even a deliberateness to the fruit, an orderedness to the fruit that comes. In case the deliberateness of this life is not clear already, it becomes especially clear as we consider the alternative that the psalmist describes. The wicked are not so, but are like chaff that the wind drives away. And this image of the chaff is used again and again in Scripture to talk about life that's not rooted in relationship to God. Chaff blown by the wind, scattered, haphazard. This is a life on the fly, as it were, a life at the mercy of the prevailing winds. In stark contrast, the spiritual life is deliberate. It is intentional. It's purposeful. And we saw this in the life of Prophet Iyako. When we arrived at the center, before we knew anything about what we would be doing, or even, I think, hardly even like where we would be sleeping, we were immediately initiated into the rhythm of spiritual life of Bediako's community. Every day began with morning devotions, which include a few songs of worship, a reading from the Bible, and prayer. And it would just really start the day in a way that was centered on who God was in our midst. And students and faculty would work hard all day. Everyone would work really hard. But at the end of the day, we again end it with afternoon devotions. And every single member of the community participated. And we would pray for all kinds of things. We prayed for anyone who traveled. We prayed for the internet connection when it went down. It's like, internet's out. Let's pray, right? I mean, it's life of the community. We can't get work done. The internet connection is out. Let's pray for it. We prayed for folks as they arrived, for their extended time at the center, and folks as they left. We prayed for healing for anyone who was sick. And those devotions framed the whole day as an act of worship. Everything that we read and learned and wrote, our work itself became a spiritual practice of intimacy with a God who is alive and at work in our lives and in our world. And these patterns of life, these practices, it was obvious to us that these were both the fruit of and also kind of the fuel for Prof. Bediako's kind of life, his deep rich spiritual life. And it's this intentionality and deliberateness that actually, I think, gives us the life that we want. A friend of mine, who's a pastor up in Boston, describes this as as the power of the pre-made decision. The pre-made decision. This is the decision made ahead of time that allows us to make and keep commitments. It's kind of the mechanism of commitment. You know what this is about if you've ever committed to practicing a musical instrument, or if you've ever committed to get in shape. It doesn't work to make the decision every morning whether or not to run. I've actually tried this. I can give you experimental proof. It does not work well. In the morning, it never seems like a good time to go running. If you wake up every morning and ask yourself, should I go running this morning? And the answer is no. Almost always. In my case, always, right? The decision has to be made beforehand. And crucially, my friend says, the pre-made decision counterbalances our hesitancy to make intentional choices when it comes to relationships, especially. Right? We're especially hesitant to be intentional when it comes to relationships, even any kind of relationship that we might hope to have with God. Somehow, we've bought into this myth that relationships ought to just come naturally. But I think if we pause for a moment, we know that this isn't true. We may have bought into an ideology that says that our friendships are simply natural and spontaneous, but the fact is that they are nourished over the long haul. We know that they're nourished over the long haul by intentional decisions to prioritize our friends. We make time for one another. We schedule things. We're intentional about our relationships. We certainly know this when it comes to marriage, right? That's why we make vows. So that I don't have to decide moment by moment every day, like whether I'm going to love my wife all over again. That is not on the table moment by moment. And it's a good thing, right? I made a pre-made decision so that I don't have to make that decision moment by moment. And it's a good thing I did, because let me tell you, in the heat of arguments or with Junia up in the middle of the night, seriously, 2:30 in the morning, try relating to someone healthily at 2:30 in the morning. If I had to decide at 2:30 in the morning with a screaming baby whether I was going to kind of like be in or out of this relationship, bad news, right? The power of the pre-made decisions, I don't have to make that decision there. I don't have to make it. It's already made for me, and I can get through those times. Jesus talked about much the same thing in terms of what he described as counting the cost. It's here in something he had to say, recorded in Luke 14. He said, "For which of you, intending to build a tower, does not first sit down and estimate the cost to see whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it will begin to ridicule him, saying, 'This fellow began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king, going out to wage war against another king, will not sit down first and consider whether he is able with 10,000 to oppose the one who comes against him with 20,000? If he cannot, then, while the other is still far away, he sends a delegation and asks for the terms of peace." Now, the first time I read this, it seemed to me that it was possible, at least, to read this passage, and maybe it's like the first kind of most obvious reading, is to read this passage as being about making a good decision about whether or not to undertake a really difficult task. All right, so just boil down to this, right? If you don't have enough money, don't build the tower. If you don't have a large enough army, don't fight the battle. But I don't think that's ultimately the point. And I think this becomes particularly obvious in the second half of the passage, the part we have up here about the battle. From other things Jesus has said, and if you'd like, that's a fuzzy gloss. You should be suspicious. So come ask me later. But for now, suspend your disbelief. And from other things that Jesus said, I think it's pretty clear that the battle between kings that Jesus has in mind, when he talks about battles between kings, this is not abstract. Jesus is constantly talking about the kingdom of God and how it was invading and displacing the kingdom of Satan, the kingdom of evil that rules the world as it is. God, the good king, is invading. He's coming to our rescue. And the question is whether we want to join this king in this battle. And so from this vantage point, making peace, like sending out an emissary to make peace with Satan, to make peace with evil, is probably not really on the table, right? This is not like the answer that Jesus is hoping you will give. This is not the solution he's hoping you'll find. The point is not about what decision to make. The point is about when to make that decision. The point is to make your decision before you're in the midst of the battle. The point is to make a pre-made decision. Because as we heard last week from Asha, our lives are a battle. And the front lines are the small decisions that we make every day. When it comes down to it, I actually think there are probably relatively few really large, big decisions. Now, those very few big decisions are important, don't get me wrong. But for the most part, who we become is determined by thousands of small decisions made again and again over the course of our lives. For example, I'm going to get pretty practical here. Many of you know that on Sunday mornings, we have some folks that help facilitate a service for Agape Church for the Homeless, right? You've been invited, if you've been around here a few times, to come check that out. Or take the invitation to come be a part of Abraham's Tent, this another outreach to the homeless that's going to be hosted right here at our friends at United. Now, deciding not to do one or the other of these events does not make you an enemy of the poor. Let's just get that clear, right? Okay? So, of course, that's totally true. And in fact, deciding to do one or the other of these events does not absolve you of all future responsibility to the poor either, right? These are not big decisions in that sense. But here's the thing. When it comes to becoming friends of the poor, which we'll talk about later as a spiritual practice that puts us in connection with God, when it comes to that, there's actually no bigger decision to make than these kinds of small decisions about whether to go to Agape on a Sunday morning or help out with Abraham's Tent or any number of other things, right? All these small things. It's not like there's some more important decision coming down the road. All there is one big chain of similarly small decisions, either into or out of life with God. And as I said, like being with the poor, I think, is a part of life with God, and we'll talk about that. So let me get even more embarrassingly practical about this. just make a program note on our gathering here, right? When we do announcements on Sunday, someone came to me, I've heard multiple times, why are announcements so long at EZP? we're talking about this at staff meeting. It's not because Alyssa should just speak, 1,000 words a minute. It's because when we believe that the things that we're inviting all of us in to do together are things that will lead us into the spiritual life that we desire and that God desires for us. And so in some ways, as we've talked over the short life of this church, we said, you know what, in some ways, I think announcements might be the most important thing, the most important part of our gathering. All right, I'll soften that. A most important part of our gathering. Because they are an invitation into life with God, into making those small decisions that lead us into the life that we've always wanted. But these decisions are not made in a vacuum, right? That's what this passage, I think, can clue us into. They're part of a battle that's raging in the world. Let there be no doubt about it. There is very little in our culture or in the brokenness of our own hearts that wants us to decide to become friends of the poor, or to live life at a reasonable pace, or to learn to hear the voice of God in prayer or in scripture, or to invest our money in the things of God, or to live in honesty and candor about our weaknesses and our failings. These are the practices that we will talk about during this season. Instead, there is a steady tide pressing against those things. And if we should choose instead to press into them because we want to live the spiritual life that they nourish, then there will be costs. But by making, I think, the pre-made decision and counting the cost ahead of time, we find the resolve to take our stand. Again, language that we've gotten from Ephesians. Take our stand and live a purposeful, deliberate, intentional life that puts us in relationship with a God who loves us and wants good things for our lives. And then after there, the fruit grows naturally, right? These right relationships with our families, with our neighbors, with our city, and with our world. Again, let me get super practical. When I'm including myself in this, you'll hear a story later. I'll make this all clear. When you think about coming to church on Sunday or going to home group, that decision, in fact, is not made in a vacuum. There are pressures that militate against setting aside time to be with God and be with God's people. And if you wait to make that decision, I've been there, if you wait to make that decision until, 3:45 on Sunday or 15 minutes before your home group starts, I've been there, I will decide not to go. Or at least often that will be your decision, right? Because the good thing that you want to do, the thing that would be fruitful for your life, never looks less appealing than right before it's about to happen. Have you learned this? Why is that? Because your enemy in this battle doesn't want you to go, doesn't want you to invest in these things, doesn't want you to make these small decisions that'll lead you into the life that you want and that God wants for you. The only way you'll go and go regularly, and going regularly is likely to be the only way in which it will actually bear the kind of fruit that we desire to begin with, is if you decide well in advance that you're not deciding at the last minute. Your decision is pre-made. You're going. End of story. This, I take it, is the power of the pre-made decision. I told you that this is all at least in part autobiographical. My freshman year of college, I hardly ever went to church. I think I may have stumbled out to church like twice or something the entire year. It was exactly like I was saying, right? Each morning seemed to be an especially bad morning to go to church. I could tell myself every morning, I'm the kind of person who goes to church. It's just that this day, I mean, seriously, the Pope wouldn't go to church today. And that's how it went for my entire freshman year. But that whole year, even while I was making those decisions, through other things that were happening on campus, God was at work in my life. And so the summer between my freshman and my sophomore year, I made a pre-made decision. I was going to go to church. So I persuaded the folks in Yale Christian Fellowship, where I had been encountering Jesus, to make it a project to help students, including students like me, find their way to a church, to a local church. And so since I wanted to get connected, I thought I would personally take on the task of putting together a list of churches I figured I want this information anyway. Why don't I just put it together myself? We're doing this, and I'm working on this. And the first Sunday of my sophomore year rolls around, and I was desperate to get in touch with a local covenant church that was in town. I had grown up in a covenant church, and I thought, hey, it's the place to start, right? Well, I had been calling. It's not exactly before the internet, but it was before the internet at the Covenant Church of New Haven, who may be wonderful people. By the way, I have not met them. I can only say wonderful things about the Covenant Church in general. But I couldn't get a hold of them, and I was calling even that morning. I thought someone will be in the church building for service. So like, if I call on Sunday morning at some point, they'll hear the phone ringing, and I can go. I don't think I even knew exactly where I was far from the end of my road for my plan to go to this church. So it was after 10 o'clock, no one was picking up, and it was getting dire, right? Because it was already after 10. And suffice it to say that freshman year Matt at this point would have said, well, you know, I tried. It's just not in the cards, like, for sure. Like, this is a sign from the Lord. I clearly oughtn't go to church today. But I had made a pre-made decision. I was going to go to church one way or the other. And as it happened, of course, somewhat strategically, I had this list of churches sitting on my desk. And by this time, since it was after 10 a.m., there was really only one church that I could meet, that I could still make. Do you see how hard life was before ECV? By 10 a.m., you couldn't go to church. Anyway, 10 a.m., I'm sitting there, and I'm saying, how am I going to go to church? But there was this one church, the Vineyard Church, that was at that time meeting in Hamden. Rides were leaving from Phelps Gate in, like, 5 minutes. So I was like, okay, I decided I'm going. I, like, book it down to Phelps Gate. I was in Morse College, for those of you who know where these places are. And so I'm, like, sprinting. I find some stranger who's like, yeah, I'm giving rides to the Vineyard. I get into her car. And I'm like, okay, we're going to church. This is great. We get in there, and after a few songs of worship, not totally unlike our service here, the drummer gets up and starts giving the announcements. I'm like, right on, drummer. Like, this is kind of cool. And then he just transitions into giving the sermon. And I'm like, dude, the drummer is preaching. And then I had an even more kind of like, I paused a little bit more, like putting it together. Wait a minute, the pastor, okay? So young musician Matt was like hooked. I was like, all right, this is good. I hooked at least enough that when I got back to my dorm after church and had to run off to the freshman bazaar with my completed list of churches, there was still a blank on my list of churches. I had no student contact for the Vineyard. And I thought, well, I've been there once, and it was okay. So I put down my name as the student contact for this church that I had visited precisely once. And so I was stuck for the next 8 weeks or so. Freshmen would call me about going to the Vineyard. And I had to go with them. Like, hey, I hear you go to the Vineyard. I'm like, why, yes, I do. And so I just had to go because I was the contact person. And through that commitment, through that pre-made decision, I discovered a spiritual life in which God was real in ways that I had never imagined possible. Real, frankly, in ways that were so offensive initially to me, honestly, that if I hadn't had that, like, kind of, if I didn't have to go, I would have totally bailed. I would have walked out of there for sure. But through that pre-made decision, my spiritual life was transformed. I made some of the most important relationships of my life. And it wouldn't be overstating things to say that the entire trajectory of my life was radically changed. And here I am, lead pastor at a Vineyard church. I didn't know what the Vineyard was. I thought it was a rock band when I went. It wouldn't be going too far to say we would not be in this room today, all of us together here, if that pre-made decision hadn't been prompted by God. So, let me challenge you. During this season of Lent, we've got this faith experiment underway. It's kind of various different things that Alyssa talked you through. And for each piece of this experiment, there's a pre-made decision to be made. Right, so we're going to be doing this teaching series. I was going to fix that. But anyway, on trying out spiritual practices. And so let me challenge you, radically enough, decide now. You could just make a decision now. Think about all the headache you would save yourself for the next 6 weeks. If you just decided now, I'm just going to go to church from now until Easter every week. I'm just not even going to wonder. I'm just going to do it. You could do that. Additionally, you could also decide now to try each of these practices that we'll talk about. Even if you don't yet know what you think about God or about Jesus or whatever, you can treat this as an experiment. Try out the practices and see if you find the fruit of the spiritual life that we're all looking for. We'll also be reading through highlights from the life of Moses in the Bible. You could make a decision now to do that each day of the week. If you're not, there's some wiggle room. You can catch up if you miss a day. But maybe you haven't ever or haven't for a long while read the Bible or had an encounter with God in that text. I encourage you to try it out. See what you find. Or we're praying in kind of three different directions. First be, you know, think of one thing that it would take God to do in your life that you would really like to see happen in your life. Take a risk. Commit, make a pre-made decision to pray for that regularly during Lent. Each year when we do this, we see prayers answered and kind of see evidence that God indeed is at work in our lives. Commit to praying for six folks in your life who you would like to have experience more of God's blessing in their lives. Again, maybe you're not even sure that there is a God who's interested in blessing these folks. But look at it this way. If God is real, right, and you pray for good things in people's lives, like, they can't hurt. This is the lowest bar I can give you, right? This is like the lowest wage, right? It can't hurt. But think about what would happen. What if God did? What if your like next door neighbor that hasn't had a job in months, you start praying for them and they have a job? Well, that would be a great thing, right? Because all of a sudden they have a job. And you know, or have some evidence to suggest to you that God might be real and at work in the world. Okay, I think this is a good thing. You should do this. And decide today on your little handout. You have a worksheet. Decide today whom you might pray for. Finally, as a church, you know, if you've been around here for a while, you know, and if you don't, this will help you get to know us. We are 100% committed to being led by God, hearing God's voice, and following in obedience. And so as we were praying in various different leadership meetings for what we ought to pray for during this season, we felt like God clearly spoke to us. It was remarkable, actually, the way that God spoke to us and said, hey, I think you should be, why don't you pray for children and youth in your city? Why don't you pray for children and families? And we felt challenged specifically to pray that God would use us as a church to bless children and the youth of our city. And so we felt challenged to pray boldly that God would add kids and youth to our number here on Sundays and other things that we do as a church. And that felt risky, right? Because again, if you know us a bit, you know that we generally guard numbers here. We tend to downplay ECV in particular and want to talk up our partnerships with the other great folks that are doing great things in this city. But we felt like we heard pretty clearly a challenge from God to become an oasis for children and families in our city and to be bold in living into that identity, to be willing to say, this is who God has called us to be. God is at work here. You know, God's work changes our lives for the better. So we will be bold in our goal that more people will come and have their lives changed through an encounter with God in our midst. And so I hope that you've actually started to hear a little bit of that boldness already in what I've had to say today. We want to pray more into that during Lent. And during this season, Hannah and I will be hosting a prayer meeting specifically for praying for the young people in our city and the families in our city Thursday nights at 9:30. You'll get an email about that. Come and pray. God is speaking. We want to be listening. And as we listen, we already kind of have some things I'd be excited to share with you. I don't have time right now. Come to these meetings, all right? Because I just feel like there's some specifics, mentoring programs, all kinds of things that we feel like God might be leading us to do. So come, and even if you don't, you'll hear in this context and in others more about kind of the steps that we feel called to take in obedience to what God is telling us. So if you're keeping, you know, score at home and you want your spiritual practice for the week, I suppose it is simply this, right? This is the pre-made decision. Other people might call it commitment, but I think we get specific about it. This is the mechanism of commitment, the kinds of decisions that we want to make, the decision made in advance to invest ourselves in relationship with God so that we can walk into the spiritual life that we desire, the life that we've always wanted. I promised you you would hear from Prof. Bediako at least once more. In this video, which I didn't know it existed until like yesterday, I was so excited to find this stuff. Prof actually talks about his experience of what it was like for him to come to that point of decision to say, I'm going to invest my life in a relationship with God. Here he is.
Come to a point in my life, I had done well academically. Everything was going for me, as we'll say, in modern language. And yet, there was this pit of futility within, which was that caused me to begin to review my life. Suddenly, it occurred to me, I come to a dead end. And I think I remember saying something to this effect: God, I'm tired. Take my life. Now, I didn't pray. I didn't know what God I was talking to. Instead, what happened was, I didn't fall. I literally crumpled under the shower. I didn't turn on the tap. Yet I felt a drop on my foot. This was a tear. I didn't realize that. Take my life, I said. Then somehow, I felt flooding into me a newness of life. Quickly got up, had my shower, went back to my apartment room, and I'd never done this ever before. I spent half of that night in prayer. I wish to define myself as a Christian, as an African Christian. Not because a European has told me so. Indeed, my exposure to Europe made me atheist. In becoming Christian, 33 years ago, in France, on my own, under the shower, in the summer break, on the campus of University of Bordeaux, I discovered I was becoming African again. I was recovering my sense of the spirituality of life. I was recovering my sense of the nearness of the living God. I was recovering my African sense of the wholeness of life.
Many of us here at ECV have experienced this nearness of the living God, the love of God that brings newness of life and awareness of the spirituality of life. That encounter, that the transformation in that encounter is why we're here. God is pursuing us, and we want to live in purposeful response to that pursuit of God.